All right, everybody, welcome to this post Ryder Cup edition of Jay Flemma Sports Report. I am Jay Flemma, and you are listening to the Golf News Net Radio Network on iHeartRadio. Well, another year, another flame out in Europe for the USA Ryder Cup team. They are now 0 for 30 years in trying to wrest a Ryder Cup back from European soil. And on a lot of occasions, we just get plain shellacked. There were a couple of 17 and a half to 10 and a half drubbings. There was an 18 and a half to 9 and a half drubbing. This one was 16 and a half to 11 and a half. So whether it's Paris, Rome, Gleneagles, or Ireland, the team is just not ready to play when they get over there. It's plain and simple, and two facts stand out that we'll talk about during the course of the show. One of those being Zach Johnson's one of my favorite people, but unfortunately for him, the captain's picks did not work out. They were 4-12-1. I have to question the wisdom of having six captain's picks because it creates a little bit of too much temptation to go down the list to pick friends' favorites, guys that are hot, and not look at the numbers. Granted, I'm not saying the analytics are the all-important thing to review, but at the same time, we can't get too zany now, can we? And the other fact that was terrible for the U.S. is we went 7-1. Sorry, let's reverse that. 1-7. In the foursomes format. Ryan Ballengee was out there in Rome. He was also at the Solheim Cup. He is our editor, producer, and publisher here at Golf News Net. And he'll be coming on as the second guest of the show. But our first guests of the show are Equal Parts Golf and Skiing. They run an absolutely fantastic podcast and radio show out of Reno called Ski Talk. Please welcome our first guest, Phil Pugliese, and his wonderful, brilliant, lovely wife, Tricia Pugliese. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us, Jay.
So, yeah.
Did you have fun watching the Ryder Cup at least?
We did. I did.
Yeah, I mean, with the 9-hour time difference, that was a little awkward being here on the West Coast, but we did make sure that we got up early and watched it. Some of our favorite players, Ricky, we didn't get to see him as much as we would have wanted to. A little under the weather, but overall, it was definitely enjoyable.
Do you have any thoughts or opinions on how or why the U.S. might have lost, or any ideas for any improvement?
I'm not sure we lost, but we got our butts kicked. I mean, the Europe was just, as I was saying, Rahm was burning. I mean, John Rahm was definitely on fire. And I mean, all those chip-ins were just unbelievable. I mean, how do you defend against that?
You don't. You have to expect it almost. Okay, magical things happen in the Ryder Cup. It's seemingly an exponential occurrence. Okay, it's one after the other, but the same thing can happen with chokes too. Let me ask you this sort of thought.
Yeah.
How often do either of you ever play foursomes or team golf in general?
Really, we've only done a couple of scrambles. But outside of doing a few scrambles, we tend to just go out and play together.
Yeah, we're recreational golfers. We're not competitors. And like I said, like Trish says, we just limit to some scrambles here and there with associations that we might work with.
Do you often see in recreational golf those formats, though?
Honestly, don't. I mean, we play our best ball, but that's one of the things we do enjoy about watching the Ryder Cup is we get to see these types of formats played.
I wonder if perhaps the rank and file golfer, the casual golf fan, if they put together more tournaments like this, even if it's just, say, Reno versus Tahoe. Okay, my 10 favorite radio broadcasters in Reno are going to take on the 10 favorite radio broadcasters in Tahoe in a Ryder Cup style. Perhaps if people played it more often, especially media types like us, might it catch on a little bit more? And in a way, might it file sort of a grassroots growth of the sport that might filter up?
There's potential for that for sure. I mean, watching the Solheim this year and the Ryder Cup was the first time I really experienced watching anything like this thoroughly and just really getting into it. And I was fully immersed in both of them.
I agree with that. And I think this could be a lot of fun. I mean, all of these different types of formats that we don't see that much, and variations, I think, can make it fun for a lot of people.
Now, you've been on a bunch of golf adventures over the last few weeks, especially this summer. Why don't you give us a rundown of some of your favorite golf events that you've either watched or participated in over the course of the summer?
You want to start with that?
I'll start. Well, we basically got back into golf this summer. I mean, both Trish and I dabbled in it for the past couple of years, off and on for maybe the past 20 years. But this past year, with a few connections, we jumped back in with both feet. And Trish started taking lessons. I took some lessons also. And we had a chance really to get out a little bit more. And it was enjoyable. I mean, some of the events, the main event that we're at was the U.S. Ski and Snowboard Hall of Fame event that was at the Promontory Golf Course, Country Club in Park City. I mean, we had an opportunity there, and they were fantastic to work with. They bring in four charity events a year, and we were fortunate enough to be one of those events to be able to experience that magnificent course. And that was a scramble format, so that was good. And I was also back east for the West Virginia Ski Hall of Fame. They had their event up at Timberline, and I got to play that course with that organization, which was also a ton of fun. But it gives us a chance in our industry. There's a lot of crossover between skiing and golf, and those were enjoyable events for me.
Yeah, I mean, I really appreciated all of the, you know, all of what Phil was talking about. And when we were in Utah for the U.S. Ski and Snowboard Hall of Fame event, they were giving out awards to Tom Kelly for being the Volunteer of the Year award, which was pretty spectacular. And we also ended up spending a leisure day golfing at the canyons at Park City. And it's kind of interesting because that brought it to mind how many golf courses have you golfed that are based at a ski area, and how much of the golf course is part of the actual ski area. And it was just really fun to just see the runs on the hill and be golfing underneath lift towers and stuff like that. It was pretty fascinating.
You know, one of my favorite tricks that I look for whenever I'm playing a resort golf course is to see if the architect planned a blind tee shot off the tee where you have to aim at one of the ski runs. That's one of my favorite architectural tricks. Okay, and Robert Trent Jones Jr., who probably has more resort golf courses at ski resorts than any other living or perhaps dead architect on the planet, is known for doing that usually at least once a round. I think one of the only exceptions to that might be at Sugarloaf, but if you go to Sunday River, you can pick that out at least two or three occasions. Also at Mount Snow, Jeffrey Cornish did a wonderful job there. There's a number of blind tee shots on that golf course, and you have to find out which trail you're going to use as your target off the tee. So it's very clever. I've often wondered if there was some sort of connection or synchronicity in the skill between designing the holes of a golf course and carving the trails of a ski area.
You know, it's funny you should say that, because one of our partners that we had with us when we were at the canyons was Justin Kosky's brother. He was golfing in our group, and Justin's the director of the U.S. Ski and Snowboard Hall of Fame. But he actually lined up for a shot and said, wow, in order to actually get my ball to go around where I want it to go, I have to aim at that lift tower. He goes, I hope I don't hit the lift tower. And he hit his ball, and we just heard a big giant gong. His ball actually looked up and bounced back.
Well, I've seen that happen before. When we were in Jamaica, they had giant tiki towers of stone as tee markers, and somebody smashed a drive off one directly in front of them, and it catapulted into the jungle behind. So, but now, you've had a number of other golf adventures outside of Utah as well. I'm hearing you took a trip up through Idaho and had some pleasant rounds there.
So we did. And to expand a little bit on us getting back into golf, Phil got back into golf a little bit a couple of years ago and then really got into it big time last year. But he didn't golf as frequently as he perhaps wanted to. And we took a trip up to Sun Valley and going over the Snake River by Twin Falls, Idaho, you see that golf course down there. And he said, boy, it'd be fun to golf that someday. So this year I got lessons and I started to get really addicted. And the minute I started golfing a lot, Phil started golfing a lot. And it just made it more fun for both of us because we're doing it together. So Phil has a buddy to go golfing with always. And we left Utah and Phil said, let's make a detour and go up to Twin Falls and hit that golf course while we're this close, you know? So we did, and we ended up golfing there 2 days. It was the Canyon Springs. There's a private course and a public course in that canyon. And we golfed the public course, and it is absolutely stunningly beautiful. The waterfalls, natural waterfalls coming out of the side of the canyon and the Snake River along there, just breathtaking views. We wanted to take pictures almost as much as we wanted to golf.
I've been there, at least taking the pictures, not out to Canyon Springs, but I have heard good things about it. So I'm looking very much forward to exploring the Idaho golf scene. Before we get to skiing, tell us a little bit about where you play back at home in Reno.
Well, I take my golf lessons at Wolf Run, which is in South Reno, and we live in North Reno, so it's not always convenient to drive down there to practice, and we found a great practice facility at a little course up just north of us called Sierra Sage, and so it's a high desert mountain course, a lot of sagebrush around, it's right in the name, and but it's really family friendly, and it's great, very low key atmosphere. The people that work there are super friendly. The people that golf there are super friendly, and it just makes it for an easy place. And their practice facility is probably one of the best around here.
So it's nice. The driving range is actually off of natural grass, which is always nice. But they also have what they call their 19th hole, which is about 120-yard par 3 hole that's there in the practice area that they might use that hole if they're doing maintenance out on the course. And they'll use it. They'll mix that in. It'll become the 18th hole. But what that does is it gives you a really nice green to work towards, a bunch of different shots you can work at. And they also do have another practice green too, which has a couple of pins on that. A really nice chipping area. It's got two sand traps that actually do mimic the type of sand that's out on the course, because we do run that from time to time, that the practice area is different than what's out on the course. They do a really good job with that. Two nice practice greens, and it's really a nice family-owned facility. It's not part of a big golf group like we're seeing in skiing or all these management companies that come in. This is family-run. They do a really good job with it.
I mean, the son of the owners, you can commonly see him changing garbage cans and bartending, you know, and they're just a real, real nice family-run facility.
We're talking with Phil Pugliese and Tricia Pugliese of Ski Talk, and now it's time to get right into the meat and potatoes of what they do best and what they love most. I am hearing that we have got snow all the way from Mammoth Mountain to Tuckerman's Ravine. We're hearing reports all the way from Colorado, Idaho, and Washington. Give me the lowdown, please, everybody. Where are we? How close are we to the season opening?
I say if the weather stays cold, probably the end of October, beginning of November, we'll be skiing in Reno here.
Yeah, Mount Rose has been very good as far as trying to get open early. We've had a couple of years where they've been open the last week of October, but recently and that was also with just a beginner, one short little beginner's lift. Recently, in the past 2 or 3 years, they've changed that a little bit, and they'll tend to open a week or two later with top to bottom skiing, which actually it's kind of worth the wait for that to get that extra bit of vertical. But again, we're looking probably mid mid-November here. I'm sure Colorado with Loveland and Abe Basin are going to fight for their early opening. We might get a surprise contender in there, maybe a Wolf Creek or something that might spring in to get open a little bit early. And as far as the East, of course, you've got your Killingtons and your Sunday Rivers that try to get open as early as possible. But I think there's a lot of excitement coming into this year. We see it on the equipment side as far as a lot of discussion that's coming up. And then on as far as getting out there, people just want to get out there on a hill. So we're excited to go skiing again.
Now, you read my mind. My next question was, okay, give us the latest news that's coming out, whether it's equipment or whether it's purchase of resorts or whether it is the latest, greatest craze from one of our most established athletes. What's the buzz?
The buzz is BOA. The BOA is the big discussion coming into this year, which the new closure system that we're seeing on booths from Salomon Atomic, K2, and Fisher. They've incorporated a BOA closure system on their boots, which it's on the lower half of the boot. It replaces the two lower buckles with a dial mechanism. That what it does, it encompasses that boot, encompasses the foot a lot more efficiently around the forefoot area and creates a much better connection with the foot and the boot. And some people will put BOA as just being a closure system, but I was just fortunate enough to spend some time out in Colorado and Denver at the BOA facility and to see what they have going on. And this is going to be a little preview as far as what's coming up. Some of this is bordering on being a little bit embargo, but I can tease a little bit of it. But simply, BOA does not add a closure system to a product unless they feel they can make a performance difference in that product. So with the closure system, it's not just they replace two buckles on a boot and there's a lot of sizzle. There's a lot of stake with this sizzle in that we're seeing anywhere from a 10 to a 13% increase in performance in a BOA equipped boot.
And on top of that, we're getting it from a gold standard company known for innovation.
Yes. Yes.
Very much so.
And I mean, BOA's facility, it's not just a sales call center. It's not just that they're producing these closure systems. They have full testing facilities there. They'll reverse engineer all the products that they work with. They with different types of closures, what's going to work best for that. They have a team of about 400 to 500 athletes that they work with in various disciplines besides just skiing. We're talking skiing, golf, tennis, hiking, lakey with their gloves, work boots. So, I mean, we're seeing tremendous amount of application of their products. And again, and I kind of coined the old BASF commercials. They don't make the product, they make that product better.
I remember those commercials. You'll have to forgive me. My favorite were the Maxell ones where the guy's sitting in his chair and it's like exactly. The speakers are blowing him away like a hurricane. So I'm very much in tune with exactly how good BASF products were as well. Well, what other buzz is there out there? Well, actually, before we get to that question, I almost forgot. You mentioned one of the most revered people in our sport. Introduce the casual and the expert golf fan who listened to the show to who Tom Kelly was.
Tom Kelly was the director of communications for the U.S. Ski and Snowboard team for forever.
Decades.
Forever. And he does a lot of work with a lot of really good organizations. He does a ton for the U.S. Ski and Snowboard Hall of Fame. He's just very well accomplished and very well spoken. And his award that he received when we were in Utah a few weeks ago is very well deserved. And it was really fascinating. We were fortunate enough to spend some time with him and Trace Worthington and some other people out there.
It's basically a lifetime achievement award.
Yeah, basically, yeah. Yeah. I mean, next to Billy Kidd, he probably has the second most famous hat in skiing.
Yes, without question. Okay. The hat is indeed iconic. And it also should be mentioned he served as past vice president of the North American Snow Sports Journalists Association. So his contributions to sports journalism are indelible, at least in regard to snow sports.
Very much so. And you asked what other buzz. One of the things that came up this week that's also had a lot of really good discussion is the addition of Camelback and Blue Mountain in Pennsylvania being added to the Icon Pass. And that's going to definitely add a couple more feeder hills for people to spread their wings a little bit.
Yep.
It'll also spread out the crowds a little bit too in the Northeast, and it will give Pennsylvania a number more visits as well, which is a good thing. It's nice to see that.
Yeah, they were a little more epic-centric for a while with Jack Frost, Big Boulder, and a couple of the mid part of the state, Liberty and Round Top, that were epic resorts. I think this creates a little more balance in that area. And growing up in that area, I think it's very good. So, I mean, we had good skiing in that area. We had great golf in that area, too, with some of the old style resort courses up in the Poconos, which were just tremendous tracks.
The buzz right now about down there is Bedford Springs, which is undergoing a phenomenal restoration from a regional architect in the Northeast named Ron Force, who's developed a particular talent at restoring Donald Ross courses throughout the Northeast, especially in Massachusetts and in New Hampshire. His work is outstanding. There's another favorite of mine down in that area that I like to recommend to everybody called Letter Rock, LederAch, pronounced Letter Rock, if you like. It's designed by, of all people, a Texan named Kelly Blake Moran. And it is a wild bucking bronco of a course that I'm going to visit on my last run of the year for golf in November. I usually take a 3 or 4 day spin down a little bit south of me, perhaps as far south as Virginia, but I try to hit Philly and try to hit Southern Jersey. So that's one I like to recommend as well. But getting back to skiing, one last little question before we have to go to our break, and then we're going to bring in Ryan Ballingy. Tell everybody where we can listen to your show, where we can read any of your articles, and where else we can tune in and get involved in Ski Talk.
Well, we don't really, you mentioned that we had a podcast. We really don't have a podcast, but we do have a YouTube channel, and you can look it up on YouTube, skitalk.com. And our website is where you will find all of our articles and a discussion community, as well as our ski reviews, which is skitalk.com.
Excellent. So very quickly, before we let you go, tell us some of your favorite places in the Northeast. I've gotten a few of my favorites as well. Let's see if maybe we might have crossed paths and can give everybody some recommendations to go and visit once the snow starts to fall.
Well, I'll do the Northeast. I'll let Trish do the upper Midwest. In the Northeast, Mad River Glen is still one of my favorites as far as going to there, going back there. And again, I mean, this is 75th anniversary year. I remember going there for the 40th anniversary celebration there when lift tickets were like $2 and they had $1.50 hot dogs or something along those lines. But Mad River Glen is one of my favorites. And Catamount to Lynx to Beaver is probably my favorite trail combination on that mountain. I enjoy that. That's probably my favorite. I do have a soft spot for Okemo. It's one of my little guilty pleasures of a mountain, especially some of the tree skiing there was, I think, very underrated. So that was very much enjoyable. And I had great memories at a smaller hill in New York that was rarely open called Hickory Ski Hill. And it was outside of Schenectady, about a 1,400-foot vertical drop. I just had one of those tremendous skate days where the stars aligned. This is a smaller hill, sixth largest in New York, if I recall correctly, has a couple of T-bars and a palm lift. But I just had a tremendous day skiing at that area one day. Camelback was the area that I grew up on as a kid. So I do have some great memories there of skipping school and going skiing. So
I wasn't allowed to do that.
Well, neither was I, but I did it anyway.
I would have taken a whooping. Okay. I remember one time one of my classmates, the mother and father, had the kids skiing off the roof of the house onto the snowbank but behind the house. And my mother comes running into my room with the newspaper. "This kid's in your class." I'm like, "Yeah, you're never playing with him again." I shudder to think what my mother would have thought of John and Dan Egan, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
Chris, your turn. Give us some recommendations.
So I grew up in northern Michigan, the northern part of the Lower Peninsula. And I learned a little hill with about 400-foot vertical called Caberfay Peaks. And they've just done some improvements this past year. And the Meyer family runs that. They do a fantastic job. They do a great job of developing programs to get whole families out on the hill, kids and adults alike. And I just had such great memories of taking my nephew's school. He belonged to an old 60-kid small church school. And I used to take them skiing after school. And I have so many great memories there. But outside of that, we used to go up to Boyne all the time because Boyne was only about an hour and a half away from us. And we'd ski at Boyne Mountain a lot. And, you know, cheers to the Boyne group. They've done a lot for skiing with Sunday River and Big Sky Montana. And, you know, the list goes on and on. So
the Very much so.
Kirchers have done a great job of really improving skiing for the country, I think.
It's interesting you should bring up Sunday River. As everyone knows, I'm doing a long series, a battle between Vermont and New Hampshire. I'm going to ski, you know, 15 places in each state and tell you who's better. But right now, after 12 different visits between those two states, if you were to include Sunday River would be atop the entire thing. Yeah. Although Jay Peak would only be behind by 3/100ths of a point, and Cannon Mountain 3/100ths of a point behind that. So I'm an Indy Pass guy. I fell in love with it when I first found it, and I love the lineup of mountains that they have there. My heart belongs to Whiteface, but my side chick is Jay Peak, as I like to say. I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
Jay Peak is your mistress, huh?
and a very jealous one. Okay, I've had a number of adventures there, and unfortunately, coming down the face chutes is not one of them. I'm 0-7 on the face chutes, and the last one being the most ignominious failure of them all, where I actually finally got up there and it was open and I flaked. So if you'd like to read a very funny article, and I'll tell everybody else about this one too, you'll like it. It's called "An Open Letter to Jimmy Chin, or How Does a Chicken Get Egg Off His Face?"
Okay, I'll look that up.
Jimmy does reply whenever I wrote an open letter to him, usually, unfortunately, about 9 months later. "Hey, Jay, I just got to this." It's like, "Oh, that's okay, Jimmy. I get it. I understand." So, but I would be remiss if I also didn't recommend the single most historically romantic and wonderful experiences in the East. Take your lovely wife to Waterville Valley and treat her like a Kennedy.
Yeah.
Oh, you've done it.
We did that 2 years ago. We went to Waterville Valley for the demos and it was really, really fun.
It's funny. I grew up on the East Coast and I never skied New Hampshire. I skied Vermont and I felt there's no reason to go past Vermont to New Hampshire. Because I had some pretty good skiing there. And then during the COVID years, all of the industry demos were canceled that year. And the only one that actually happened was at Waterville Valley. So we said, well, if we're going to do our job and do it well to review skis, we need to get to this demo. So I had to move west to go to Waterville Valley.
And more than you know, actually, because as it happens, the lady in charge of all of the demos up there is the wonderful Dawn Marie Jackson. She's the lead Eastern representative for Sportoma, and she runs all of the rentals out of Waterville, and she's a local celebrity up there. You know, for decades, one of the most famous skiers in New Hampshire, everywhere throughout the White Mountains. So, and plus, you know, the incomparable history, and there's just a romantic atmosphere there. Plus, the nice thing about Waterville is plenty of challenge, but not enough to knock you off your skis. You know, you'll have a good fist fight with the mountain and you'll win every time. And, you know, there's something to be said about that.
You know, and I just want to say this to the people who are interested in our gear reviews and what we do to make it happen is when we showed up at Waterville, one of the product managers said to me, Trisha, you came east for a demo? And I said, it's the only one in the country and it's our job and we owe it to our readers to do it right. So.
Well, that's the wonderful thing about Ski Talk, and that's why you're one of the gold standards in the industry.
Thank you.
We're so glad that you came on the show. I can't thank you enough. We will check in with you one more time mid-season, if that's okay, if you've got stuff to update us with.
At that point, we'll have some sneak previews of the 24-25 gear for you.
When might you be coming east, if at all, this season?
We will be coming east in November for the Snowbound show. So we're coming for that, which will be the beginning of November. So we're coming
the 7th and 8th.
Yes. And past that, I'm not sure if we're going to do any time on snow in the east, but we're going to be heading up to New Hampshire, visiting some manufacturers on that trip also. So we'll be there for about almost a week or so. So if you want
to bring your golf clubs.
I wish we had time.
Oh, that's
tempting. Make time.
That's tempting.
Remember who you're speaking to. Okay.
Can we get
a cross between Doctor Who and Willy Wonka when it comes to books? Okay. I know where all the chocolate factories are, and I love taking people to the planet of the 20-foot deep bunkers.
Yes.
Okay. Well, let's contemplate that, and since you threw the teaser out there, let's see how the weather is in November 1st.
Usually in I-90, November 2nd is the last playable weekend, because that's when the leaves are covering the golf course so badly you'll have trouble finding the ball. Yeah. However, this particular summer has not ended and hasn't shown any signs of ending. The leaves are barely turning. They're 2 or 3 weeks late, which bodes well for a late golf season.
Well,
bring your clubs and I will make it worth your while.
It's gonna be a luxury for us. We've got other stuff to bring, but we'll definitely keep it under advisement.
Outstanding. All right. We look forward to having you back on the show soon. Everybody, Jay Flemma here. We are going to be back with Ryan Balogi on Jay Flemma Sports Report. You're listening to the Golf News Net Radio Network on iHeartRadio.